Good morning. We're now back on the record in case number PU-15-90. When we left off yesterday, Montana Dakota had just completed its case, and we are now going to move on to advocacy staff's case. Before we get started, I guess, is there anything we need to address before getting going? Mr. Kuntz, did you have anything?
Not from the company.
Okay. Mr. Hsu, anything?
Yes, I handed out PSC-4, and I believe that's going to be marked and admitted as PSC-4A, if there are no objections.
Yeah, Mr. Hsu handed out yesterday all of the advocacy staff exhibits were admitted up front, and one of those exhibits was PSC Exhibit 4. Mr. Hsu has handed out essentially a revised PSC Exhibit 4. I don't think any of the data has changed, but there's some different, there's an addition to the heading. So since that was already admitted and part of the record, the new Exhibit 4 that he handed out, I'll identify that as Exhibit 4A, and that will be admitted. So,
Your Honor, I probably neglected to mention that I gave to you a copy of the work papers that had previously been filed in the docket that we marked as MDU Exhibit 15, so I'd offer those officially for the record at
sure.
This time.
Sure. Mr. Hsu, any objection?
No objection.
Mr. Kaufman?
No objection.
Mr. Jernigan?
No objection.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
No.
Okay. Exhibit 15 that we identified yesterday and Mr. Kuntz just identified, that will be admitted into the record as MDU Exhibit Number 15. And again, Exhibit PSC Advocacy Staff Exhibit 4A is admitted as well. Mr. Kaufman, did you have anything before we get started?
No, not at this time.
Okay. Mr. Jernigan?
No.
And Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
I just have a question about
sure.
the most recent discussion. Do we need to have 4 and 4A in, or should we just replace 4?
Well, I guess
since it's been
I don't have a problem with that. I just thought if it's already been admitted and is essentially part of the record, is if nobody takes any issue with just replacing the initially admitted PSC 4, we can just make the new one PSC 4 and not have two Exhibit 4s. Mr. Kuntz, is that okay with you?
That would be acceptable.
All right. Mr. Hsu? Mr. Kaufman, turning it. Okay.
No,
all right. We'll just do that. The new one, the PSC Exhibit 4 that was handed out yesterday, that will be excluded from the record. The new one that was handed out today that has the same data, just different, an additional heading, that will be the PSC Exhibit 4, and that's admitted. So, and with that, Mr. Hsu, if you're ready, you can proceed.
This time, advocacy staff would like to call Victor Shook.
Mr. Shook, before you testify, I'm required to give you an oath, advise you of the penalty for perjury in North Dakota. It is a Class C felony, punishable by a maximum fine of $10,000, maximum 5 years imprisonment, or both. Being advised of the penalty for perjury, do you promise to tell the truth in this matter?
I do.
Okay, go ahead.
Please state your name and your title for the record.
Victor Shook. I'm a public utility analyst.
Your testimony has been marked in a minute as PSC 2. If I asked you the questions for those testimony today, would your answers be the same?
Yes, they would.
Okay. And I believe you have a brief summary of your testimony as well as a settlement.
I do.
Proceed.
Okay. Good morning, commissioners. Thank you for providing me an opportunity to give my perspective on the proposed settlement agreement. Staff spent a great deal of time reviewing and calculating the revenue, expenses, returns, and rate design in this case. Based on those efforts and subsequent discussions with MDU, I believe this agreement represents a fair, just, and reasonable estimations of test year revenues and expenses. I believe that the 9.5% return on common equity is a fair return given the current market conditions and interest rates. The rate design proposed in the settlement agreement better reflects the true cost of service, moving MDU to a straight fixed variable rate structure. And we have agreed to eliminate the proposed rate stabilization plan from the case. I'll kind of walk you through the difference between the original filed $4.3 million request and what we agreed upon at 2.5. If you look at PSC Exhibit 5, that kind of breaks it down. I'll kind of talk through each of those items. The first one is adjustment for pension and post-retirement expenses. Those, as we had heard from MDU yesterday, those are We're based off of an actuarial study that can vary with market conditions up and down. So in one year we might have a benefit, the other we might have a drawback. So what we're trying to do here is kind of level that cost out over time, and what we would do is create a regulatory asset or liability depending on what would happen in that given year. And that resulted in a net reduction to the test year revenues of $311,000. The next item for insurance expense of reduction of $67,373. This was based off of a response to a data request we had with MDU. I believe the original was around $120-some thousand. And when reviewing those numbers, MDU agreed that they forgot to include some pending insurance payments or items that are they would be receiving from the insurance companies in their calculations. So they agreed to that reduction of $67,000. The next item, regulatory commission expense reduction. That is based on MDU had assumed that we would use the entire $175,000 filing fee for this case. In discussions with them, we've advised them we would only probably be using about $25,000 at most. So $150,000 of that expense would be removed, and generally those are amortized over 3 years. So we'd reduce the test year revenues by $50,000. The tax adjustment of $193,000, that's kind of broken down at the bottom a little bit more. The tax adjustment isn't quite as simple calculating the difference between the two numbers. Essentially, there is $633,000 less in taxes because the revenue deficiency calculation is less. So there's a tax effect there, and then $470,000 more because of the we're adding the increase deficiency into the test year revenue. So kind of a funny way to calculate it, but it does work out. I've calculated these numbers a number of times to ensure they're correct. So $193,000 reduction is what we will see in taxes. The return on equity adjustment, $283,000, that's the effect of moving from 10% ROE to 9.5% that we've agreed to. The firm general volume increase, this is instead of an expense adjustment, this is a revenue adjustment, so we are adding $565,000 to our projected revenues. And then the final item there is margin sharing for interruptible. This was originally shared between MDU and the customers. And this was the difference for interruptible services between the minimum distribution delivery charge and what was actually charged. In the future, this will all be used by customers. So that brings us up to $1.738 million. We're a couple thousand off there just due to rounding differences in all of the calculations. But that kind of lays out how we stepped down from 4.3 down to 2.5. And then finally, the return on common equity of 9.5% is consistent with what was approved recently by Montana and Wyoming commissions for MDU natural gas rates. And it's also consistent with the average return authorized by commissions nationwide for natural gas utilities in 2014. That concludes my comments.
Your Honor, at this time, I turn to the witness.
Okay. Mr. Koontz?
I have no questions.
Okay. Mr. Kaufman? Okay. Mr. Jernigan?
No questions.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
We have no questions. Okay. Thanks, Victor.
Commissioner Kalk?
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Victor. The you went through this and it seemed pretty straightforward. Usually in rate cases, there's something that advocacy staff finds that you just don't like. When you went through this, what really stuck out with you is out of the ordinary. It sounds like it was pretty straightforward.
It really was pretty straightforward. I mean, this final settlement is different than what we were originally proposing. But, after speaking, talking to MDU through each of those items, the couple that we were not including in the final settlement, I think they make sense. They're reasonable adjustments to take out of the settlement. So there really wasn't any one particular sticking point. I think these adjustments that we've made, nobody really, MDU didn't have a particular interest in keeping all of these items in. So it was relatively easy for us to come to an agreement on this, I guess.
Do you think we've set the stage by, if the commission agrees that a settlement agreement that we've really done is we've answered this rate case, but we're back here again next year because we haven't given them long-term certainty, we've given them a short-term Band-Aid?
I don't think so. Honestly, one of the adjustments that we had taken out, one of my original suggestions was there was a raise for MDU employees that was projected at 3.5% for 2015, but it wouldn't go into effect until May of this year. So their original revenue deficiency was calculated on that raise going across the entire year. So we had recalculated that, and it was about $150,000 less than that if we only apply it to May going forward for this year. That was one of the items we agreed to allow them to leave in their revenue requirement, just with that idea that if, you know, if we take that out now, next year they're not going to be made whole on labor expense. So we allow them to keep that item in with kind of the idea that, you know, maybe we won't see them in here quite as often.
Okay. I do have a few little more detailed questions, but just some general ones. The first one is, you talked about in the settlement agreement about the filing fee, a big chunk of that going back to the company, which that's good. If we don't use it, it goes back.
Yep.
But how can you say we're not going to use more when we've got two interveners that could appeal this thing all the way to the Supreme Court? Then what do we do?
I guess we would have to adjust in a future rate proceeding. I mean, I don't see any reason why that would happen in this case, but...
You don't? There's other interveners that may not like what we do here. We've got one saying A and one saying B. One of them is not going to be happy.
Sure.
What are our alternatives there? Because we would have to deal with it. Where does that money come from? Do we go back to the company then, and do we say...
Well, I suppose it would happen, first of all, as far as where the money would come from for our legal defense of an appeal, I don't think we would refund the application fee immediately after the proceeding is closed. So we would have the funds available to...
But if we sign this, let's just say we ink the settlement agreement, it seems to me that's a done deal. You can't say, oh, nope, it's either all or none kind of thing. You can't just pull out what you like and don't like after
sure.
It's signed.
That's fair.
Well, that's just a question for our general counsel, but that's one right. thing that just jump out pretty quick, that I don't disagree that if everything goes as quote-unquote normal, that might play out. But we've had cases where we've refunded money in other rate cases, and we've ended up having to be short.
Sure.
So that's something that will could become a discussion point, I think.
Okay.
I was a little just intrigued about how the taxes were figured differently by MDU, and you didn't like it, and then you kind of hashed it out. Was that just because the code wasn't finalized, or what was the big...
Yeah, so at the time MDU filed, the tax rates for 2015 hadn't been finalized by the North Dakota legislature. So they had used the 2014 tax amount, corporate tax rate. And by the time we're getting to this case, obviously they have finalized that. It was lower than what it was in 2014. So there was a small adjustment for that. I mean, if you look at the entire...
So there's no willful intent there? Just was,
no.
You knew that
no.
right up front, and that was just the way
yep,
it was?
Yep.
Okay. And then the insurance, you walk through a little bit. Can you explain again a little more?
Sure.
The layman's language, what exactly?
Yeah. So their original insurance expense projection of it, like I said, I believe it was about $127,000, if memory serves. That did not take into account. So part of their insurance expense is claims that have been paid out. What they didn't calculate initially was they had submitted some of those claims to their insurance companies, and they had not yet received the funds back from those companies, and those calculations were initially left out. I think just by an oversight. I don't think it was it didn't seem to be intentional. They came out with that pretty quickly.
Okay, and then you were here yesterday when I was asking, I don't even know what witness it was, about how you give a new neighborhood and the company has to pay X amount of dollars. Is there any chance that there's money that's going to be coming in from those type of projects that is not included in this revenue forecast? Did you get down to that level of looking at things?
I did look at that level. I think it's kind of an ongoing thing, kind of money coming in and going out at all times. I mean, you know, we kind of look at, you know, the big growth going on in the Bakken, but it's happening everywhere. You know, even in Bismarck, I think we see the growth happening. So while even there might be a temporary slowdown in the Bakken right now, in other areas, I don't think they're seeing that kind of reduction. So I don't see a big fluctuation up or down in those numbers in the current test year.
In the last question, you made a comment about the ROE at 9.5 was similar to other natural gas companies.
Yes.
What companies did you look at?
So You know, first of all, it was the same as what, as I said, Montana and Wyoming had granted to MDU for the natural gas.
So we're consistent with other states for them in our region.
We are, but also additionally, there's a Public Utilities fortnightly magazine published.
And where this, I'm going with this, Victor, is we had a witness yesterday telling us that there's nobody quite like MDU. Mm-hmm. And then you're telling me, but you found other companies like them. I'm trying to just reconcile those two.
Sure. So the first example of, you know, MDU in Montana and Wyoming, I think they're very similar to MDU North Dakota. Obviously, they're going to be a little bit smaller. But the second example is just kind of in general, as far as, you know, natural gas companies across the nation. And while they're not going to be similar in size to MDU, it seems to be a good indication that we're probably going in the right direction with a 9.5% ROE.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Victor. No questions.
Commissioner Fedorchak.
Thank you, Judge. Thanks, Victor. We came back today, so you had to wear a suit 2 days in a row.
Goes for Red Hill, too.
Oh, and most staff. Good chance to use it, right?
Yeah.
Okay. You did just expenses. Is that what you analyzed?
Yes, expenses. I also looked at rate base.
Okay, rate base. So just for starters, tell me, what did you focus on? How did you decide where to focus your review of their expenses? Did you look at everything? Just help me understand.
Sure. So I did look at everything, you know, kind of start out with the general statement, comparing – you know, what the current – so comparing what 2014 was, what they're projecting for 2015, and then looking at some historical years. You know, some of the numbers are going to be a trend going up because they are experiencing growth. Some of them may not see that kind of a growth. It may be more of a fixed type of a fee where we would expect it to be similar year after year. So I can't say there was one method of saying whether or not a number was reasonable, but certainly the – kind of the way it started, like I said, is that at the top level, you know, looking at the big numbers for, you know, O&M in general, you know, did that move up or down in a reasonable number? And then drilling down into each of the items that make up the O&M expenses and all the other expense categories, just looking at the changes to see if they were reasonable, and then digging into anything that didn't seem like a normal change, you know, anything over a few percentage points, you know, maybe 5 or 10% year over year seems like something that should be dug into, and that was kind of my methodology.
Okay. What you mentioned one of the items that you found that didn't make its way into the settlement agreement, that being the pay adjustment. What else didn't make it? I was looking through your testimony. It seems like most of the other things did, but I might have missed
something. Believe everything else did. Nothing's popping into my head at the moment.
On the expense side? I'm just curious because I read, and I can't remember where, that staff had originally reduced the revenues to like $1.4 million or something like that. So there's about a $1 million difference between where you settled and where what you originally proposed. So I'm curious what those distinctions were.
I believe so. It was $150,000 for labor. There was also an additional, I think it was $86,000 for it was grouped in with 401k expense. It is essentially a I'm trying to think of what the term is for it. It was kind of a margin sharing for employees. Essentially, if the company achieves its objectives for margins, then I think it's up to 1% of their of their salary can be added into their 401k.
In the settlement, you allow that,
right?
Okay. That was the employee incentive
program? Yes, it was.
Okay. So, all right. So those are the big one differences on your side of things. There must have been some on Mike Diller's as well.
Peek
to make
through
up
my
that adjustment.
Items here. Yeah, as far as expenses, those were the only items that did not make it.
Okay. I think that concludes my questions.
Commissioner Christman?
Rate design questions are for Mr. Diller?
Yeah.
Okay. Then the only other thing I wanted to ask about, you mentioned Montana and Wyoming, but what is South Dakota's ROE for MDU?
I guess I don't know off the top of my head.
They haven't had a case in a long time?
I don't know of any recent cases. I guess I have. I didn't check into South Dakota's case history. I remember trying to at one point. It was a little more cumbersome to try to find my way through their online database.
Okay. No other questions. Thank you.
Mr. Hsu?
Nothing further, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Koontz?
There's a couple things, Mr. Shook, I want to try to clear up. Are you aware that there's a pending South Dakota case that Montana and Dakota has before the South Dakota Public Service Commission?
I am not, but I am now.
Okay. I want to talk a little bit about the rate case expense. This was a 2015 test year, correct?
Correct.
That the company used. And in a test year, that necessarily means that you're going to be projecting some expenses, correct?
Yes, correct.
And because the test year is not over, obviously.
Right.
And that means there's estimates that go necessarily involved in setting that test year, correct?
Correct.
So for a rate case expense, the company had estimated the full $175,000 filing fee. Is that right?
That's correct.
And you're estimating that you're only going to need $25,000, correct?
Correct.
And the company agreed with that?
Yes.
Whatever the commission actually spends and charges the company, that's what it will end up expensing and amortizing over time, correct?
Correct.
The rate case may have a projected number for purposes of setting rates, but the company's expense is going to be whatever it is.
That's correct.
So if the commission only spends $24,000, there'll be a little bit more in the rate case than test year than what was actually spent, correct?
That's correct.
And if they spend $30,000 and build a company, the company's going to be a little short in the test year.
Yes.
Correct? But that's just the nature of projecting test year expenses.
Correct.
So the commission's not going to be short, if you will, in terms of it needs to spend $30,000. That's what it'll be. If they spend $150,000, the company might be a little harder to settle that issue the next time around. Would you agree with me?
I would.
The other item that Commissioner Fedorchuk asked you about, the big difference between what the company was proposing and the staff was proposing, you didn't mention ROE. The difference between the staff's ROE proposal and the company's 10% ROE, is that right?
That's correct. That's a very good point.
Did you calculate what the difference would have been? Would that make up that difference, that margin, that and the taxes, tax effect of that?
I think it would, yes.
That's all the questions I have.
Mr. Kaufman?
I don't know that I have a question about your testimony, Mr. Shook, but you were asked a question by Commissioner Calk about the settlement agreement itself.
Yes.
And just let me know if you feel like it's a legal question, but I assume you were had a part in putting together the document.
Yes.
And you're aware that there's a provision about modification that does kind of contemplate that the commission could modify the settlement agreement or condition it on some change?
Yes.
So that's part of the process, isn't it?
Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Jernigan?
No questions.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
We have no questions. Thank you.
Okay. Commissioner Kalk? Commissioner Fedorchuk?
No more. Thank you.
Commissioner Chrisman? Okay. Mr. Hsu, is that it for Mr. Shook?
That's all, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Shook.
This time, advocacy staff would like to call Aaron Rothschild. Is he on the line right now?
Yes, this is Aaron Rothschild. I'm here.
Okay. Mr. Rothschild, before you testify, I'm required to give you an oath, and I need to advise you of the penalty for perjury in North Dakota. It is a Class C felony punishable by a maximum fine of $10,000, a maximum 5 years imprisonment or both, and being advised of the penalty for perjury, do you promise to tell the truth in this matter?
Yes, I do.
Okay, go ahead, Mr. Hsu.
Mr. Rothschild, would you please state your name and place of employment for the record?
Yes, Aaron Rothschild and Rothschild Financial Consulting.
Could you give us a brief summary of your experience?
Yes, I've been testifying as a cost of capital witness since 2001 and also before that in various positions in telecommunications companies and business planning. Dealing with financial issues.
Have you testified on in any natural gas cases and for public utilities with cost of capital in the past?
On behalf of public utilities?
Oh, Just
was that your question?
No, just in rate cases for public utilities, for natural gas specifically.
Yes.
Now, your testimony has been previously marked and admitted at PSC Exhibit 3. And if I ask you the questions as laid out in your testimony, would you give me the same answer today?
Yes.
Would you give us a brief summary of your conclusions?
Yes. I recommend an ROE or cost of equity of 8.62% based on my simplified DCF analysis, and an overall cost of capital of 6.9% based on the company's requested capital structure. And I used the same proxy group as Dr. Gasquet did in my calculations. I used the same calculations, and he received a mean return of between 8.99 and 9.04%, so about 40 basis points higher than me. And the main point that was addressed in my testimony is a difference between the specific risks for the company.
Mr. Rothschild, would you give us a brief comparison between NDU and the other companies in the proxy group?
Yes. One of the main pieces that I bring up in my testimony in terms of a difference is the companies in the proxy group, the nine of them, include also non-regulated operations as well. So that was one of the main points that I showed, and they included 40% of revenues from non-regulated operations was one of the main differences.
Yeah, I have no further questions, Your Honor.
Mr. Kuntz?
I have no questions.
Mr. Kaufman?
No questions.
Mr. Jernigan?
No questions.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
No questions. Okay.
Commissioner Kalk?
Just thank you for your testimony and your very thorough filed testimony. I don't have any questions for you.
Commissioner Fedorchak?
Nor do I.
Okay. Commissioner Christman?
I didn't write quickly enough. Would you just repeat your two recommendations again?
So the cost of equity or an ROE is 8.62%, and an overall cost of capital of 6.9% based on the company's requested capital structure.
Okay, no other questions. Thank you.
Mr. Hsu, anything further? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Rothschild.
Okay, thank you.
You ready for your next witness?
Sorry, this time I'd like
to have a question, though, just in general. The previous witness, Victor, talked about the rate case. How much did this guy cost? We had to pay him something. That numbers don't seem to add up. Okay, so that's where you're getting your 25, but that was a big chunk of it. Okay.
This time I'd like to call Michael Diller.
Mr. Diller, before you testify, I'm required to give you an oath, advise you of the penalty for perjury in North Dakota. It is a Class C felony, punishable by a maximum fine of $10,000, a maximum 5 years imprisonment, or both. Being advised of the penalty for perjury, do you promise to tell the truth in this matter?
I do.
Okay. Go ahead, Mr. Hsu.
Mr. Diller, will you please state your name and your title for the record?
Mike Diller, Director of Economic Regulation.
All right, Mr. Diller, your testimony has been previously marked and admitted as PSC Exhibit 1. If I ask you the questions that have been laid out in your testimony today, would your answers be the same?
I'm sorry, Jack, to do this to you, because I am going to change it just a little bit, if you don't mind. And I didn't talk to you beforehand. Sorry about that.
So much for prepping the witness, right?
That's my mistake. On page 23 of my testimony, and I think maybe this change will help expedite some of the AARP questions, maybe. But sometimes as a witness, you're prone to exaggerate a little bit, and so I want to change line beginning on line 17 to read, so there was no cost basis in that proceeding or the NSP proceeding. And the 3 cent per decatherm in this proceeding does not, cross out or in this proceeding too, does not justify the continued use of a variable rate. So it reads again, there was no cost basis in that proceeding, and the 3 cent per, and the 3 cent per decatherm in this proceeding does not justify continued use.
Mr. Dillon, could you give me the line with the 3 cent that you plan to change?
Well, I talk about the 3 cents per decatherm on line 12, but I'm changing line 17 to read, there was no cost basis in that proceeding, scratch out or in this proceeding too, and replace that with, and the 3 cent per decatherm in this proceeding does not.
Say 3 cents or 3%?
3 cents.
3 cents per decatherm. Maybe I've got my head down too low here, or I'm misspeaking. And then on page 26, line 8. Just change the word also to likely. Page 26, line 8, replace also with likely. And I can say, I can tell you why I changed that word also to likely right here. I guess before I get into my opening comments, I'm changing that to likely because I've not done any research into whether or not straight fixed variable would work or not with the small general firm class. But I say likely because the usage levels for the small firm commercial class is about twice what it is for residential. And so there's maybe some likelihood that it might work for the small general firm class. I'm sorry, I'm not going to go right into my opening comments until you tell me.
Are there any other changes, Mr. Diller?
Those are all the changes I have.
I believe you've prepared a brief summary.
I have.
Testimony.
I have.
Proceed.
Whoops. Commissioners, I'll be working off PSC 4 if you'd like to scribble on that, or I've also got it cast up on the wall in the back there. First of all, just maybe I'll start with this. Thank you for this opportunity to share my thoughts with you this morning. A lot of times financial analysts, we go down into our rabbit hole and do our analysis and our work, and we don't come out for days and weeks, and you wonder what we're doing. And this is my opportunity to share with you. And I don't always have that opportunity because I'm usually on the advocacy staff side, and we have that little Chinese wall that goes up about when we're involved in rate cases. So I really appreciate this time. It's when we can talk freely and openly amongst ourselves. First of all, let's look. So the first page here, let me describe what you see. The first column is the settlement rate of return before the recommended increase using the class cost of service study that staff has recommended in settlement proceedings, at least, to move the allocation of gas mains from 75% demand related and 25% customer related to 100% demand related. And so this first column adjusts for all of the revenues and expenses and rate of return adjustments that Mr. Shook just talked about using a class cost of service study that is more favorable to the residential class than what MDU has filed in its original testimony. In fact, it's if you don't do anything, if you don't make any adjustments, if you just change from 75% demand to 100% demand related on gas mains, it moves $1.5 million from the residential class to the other classes.
See it?
$1.5 million of cost recovery necessary from the residential class to the other classes. Now, you can do all, you can make all kinds of adjustments to class cost of service studies, and literally you could make them say whatever you wanted to say. So you have to use some good sense and good judgment, and I think that this is a fair class cost of service study to consider. If nothing else, it provides the commission with a range between what MDU's method and staff's recommended method. So, knowing that then, this first column is the rate of return that we expect MDU would earn with no rate increases based on our class cost of service study. So then the next column is, those are the proposed rate increases that we're recommending by class. You cannot add column 1 plus column 2 to equal column 3, because the first one is rate of return and the second one is rate increase or percent increase in revenues. But, of course, an increase in revenues definitely changes the rate of return. And so the third column is, is the rate of return after the rate increase is applied, the rate increase that we've agreed to in settlement. And so that gives you a good idea under staff's class cost of service study, what we believe the rate of return, what rate of return is being contributed by each class. And so if you go all the way down to the bottom, you'll see that 7.34, that's what Mr. Rothschild just spoke about, rate of return, and this reflects a 9.5% ROE. The next column it's just the 7.34 up and down the column so that the Excel spreadsheet works. This, in fact, you can take column 3 minus column 4, and it does equal column 5. And the significance of that is it just shows you which classes are deficient and which classes are providing a sufficient rate of return on investment used to serve that class. Now, I would like to explain a little bit of the strategy. It probably seems very, very straightforward when you look at this, but and rather than start with residential and firm, I think I will work from the bottom of the schedule and up. I personally think that, and this is going to be a little different than what the commission maybe has heard in the past, but I personally think that you should look at interruptible rates as market-based rates and that you shouldn't be all that concerned about the rate of return provided. What you should always seek for is to get as large a return from the interruptible customers as you can in support of the firm service customers, but not too much, because you certainly don't want to lose these customers. And so, in my mind, you should look at these rates as more, are they market-based, market-driven? And so my questions to MDU through interrogatories was just that. Do you have a study that has determined that these are MDU haven't done a study, but they're in the business of selling natural gas, and they have a good idea of what the market-based rate should be. And so in the end, we've not changed the large interruptible customer rate because they're not sure that they can raise those rates and not lose customers. We've increased the small interruptible rates by quite a large percent based on the total increase of 2%, and they believe that they will not lose customers at that level either. And so that helps contribute to overall earnings. The Air Force is just that's just crazy looking numbers, and if we applied the same technique that's often discussed in the commission of we don't increase rates by more than twice the overall or less than half of the overall, that those crazy numbers would never fix themselves if you practice that with the Air Force. And so we decided to be aggressive, to recommend something different and take care of half, basically about half of the excess earnings in rate 64. So if you believe in my strategy thus far, then the rest of the rate increase has to come from the residential or firm general service class. And as you can see, the firm general class is providing a 7.74% rate of return now. And this, again, this class cost of service study, these rate of returns that I'm sharing here, this is a more favorable position for residential classes than what MDU filed with their class cost of service study. And so they're already providing 40 basis points return above what we've agreed through settlement is a reasonable rate of return. And so then the residual falls to the residential class, who is not providing their fair share of rate of return on investment used to serve them. So that takes care, I think, of that schedule. The other issue that's before you is this idea of straight fixed variable rate for MDU's residential class. And so I've tried to put up a number of bullet points here, and some of them may be redundant, and I'm going to use these as talking points. The very first one, I indicate the value of straight fixed variable rate for MDU's residential class is that it matches NSP's rate structure. We put this into the commission, put this into place with NSP Gas back in 2005. In that case, we increased the basic service charge from $5.50 to $15.68. That decision was reaffirmed in 2007, case number PU 06525, and NSP's gas rate went to $18.48 a month. In that case, we also ordered that NSP would spend almost $250,000 a year on energy efficiency. And they were more than willing to do that, because after you get rid of a volumetric charge, then there's no disincentive for a company to promote energy efficiency. And so if you think about it, they've spent about $2 million since the last rate case on energy efficiency, and it's not harmed the company, and it's been beneficial to their consumers. So positive experience is the next bullet. I guess the energy efficiency programs was part of that, but they haven't had a rate increase since 2007, and it seems like just yesterday when you've been doing this so long. they haven't had a rate case since 2007 under this straight fixed variable rate. And I remember them wringing their hands and questioning whether this was the right way to go, because, my goodness, if we can't increase sales, how do we make more money? We've got to be dependent upon growth in the area, and it's very nice when something works out the way it has. Right now, Mr. Shook is working with NSP possibly to amortize costs early, because earnings are sufficient to handle that. I don't know where that negotiation is. So, but in any event, it's worked out well for the company. And it's worked out well for customers. Back in 2005, I got a lot more of the customer complaints than I do now. Stacy does such a fabulous job. Sometimes I don't get the same customer input that I used to. And if it was rate case, Mike hit the mic button. And so I took most of those complaint calls after we went from $5 to $15. And some of them were pretty angry about it. The total number was somewhere around 10, 15 customers. And what was interesting was the majority of those, once I explained that, now do you realize the distribution delivery charge is not going to be on your bill? No. So your net increase is not really $10 a month. And once they understood that part of the bill was disappearing, most of them were more than satisfied. I would say two or three were still pretty hot about it. And all right. The next one, matches system design. Tammy Aberle talked quite a bit about that yesterday, and I don't know if I need to go into that again, other than to say that I think it was last week, Vic works with a man, an MDU employee on damage prevention out in the Williston area, and that's a big hotbed of growth out there. And so since he had that connection, I said, let's call him up and let's talk to him about what his mindset is. How does he decide what kind of main to put in? And he was a little nervous because he didn't have authorization from the higher ups. But I just kept him talking and pleading with him to share what he knew, and he did. And I said I wouldn't tell anybody his name, and then I fessed up to these guys, and they said that's fine, Mike. So if he's listening, I wanted to explain that. It was a very interesting conversation because I said, all right, so just tell us, how do you decide what size mains to put into a place? And he said, well, we estimate the number of residential units and the apartments and any other businesses that might be going to go into that area, and then we size it accordingly. I said, well, so do you calculate the square footage of the homes that are going in there? And no, we just use an average. Everybody has the capability of accessing the amount of gas they need, and so we just base it on average. And I thought that was interesting, and that maybe answers some of the questions that I heard yesterday. So the system is designed, it's plowed in, it's sitting there, it's ready for customers to use whether they use it or not. And so I would say that argues for a fixed cost, a straight fixed variable rate. The next bullet there eliminates the distribution delivery charge. Anytime you can get a charge off of a bill, that's a good thing, I think. It makes the bill simpler and easier to understand. The next bullet is eliminates the DDSM from the bill, or the weather normalization adjustment that is applied in between November and May, I think it is. Another item off the bill. Weather normalization isn't needed under straight fixed variable, and so it just goes away. Winter bills are lower, summer bills are higher. We talked about that yesterday. Proper price signal. I think basic economics, if I had to take a few economics courses to get my accounting degree, and one of the first things you learn is that, you know, if you distort prices, there's a cause and effect to that. And so if you, let's just Well, we'll use, since we've been talking about the heat pumps, that'd be a good example. If you set the gas, the customer charge it, let's just exaggerate here for illustration, $5, and the heat pump works out to, well, you know, actually, if we can have backup gas service for $5, maybe we should install a heat pump. That distorts economic reality because it costs more than $5 to have that gas service available to that customer. The same kind of thing is that you're going to be faced on the electric side, maybe more so than the gas side, is it's the same kind of deal, and it's not gas related, but it's the same thought. If those customer charges aren't increased to cover cost, what I think is going to happen in the long run, you're going to have the more affluent people putting solar rooftops on their houses, and then those profits that you normally make through the the volumetric charges, those will go away, and they'll have to be recovered from the less affluent people or the people with less money. And proper price signals, I think, is very important, and I think that the straight fixed variable rate accomplishes that in this proceeding, matches costs with the way resources are deployed. The next one, this straight fixed variable is the simplest decoupling method in the world because there's no annual filings, there's no true-ups, energy efficiency doesn't affect earnings, weather doesn't affect earnings. There are commissions and consultants getting, well, the consultants are getting rich and the commissions are getting bogged down in revenue decoupling methods because they're so complex. There's no complexity here. If you go to straight fixed variable rate, rates are decoupled. Profits are decoupled from sales. Revenue forecasting is easier. Obviously, if in the case of residential class, if all we have to do is predict number of customers, that information is readily available. It's fairly easy to trend. It gets a little more complicated when now we also have to forecast volumes, and volumes are affected by weather, and so we're going to get into heating degree days and weather normalization calculations, and so it's not as straightforward and not as easy to do. And so under straight fixed variable, revenue forecasting will be easier, and I think as a result probably more accurate. Fixed pricing is common. I think Commissioner Kalk pointed at his cell phone the other day in the hearing, and I agree. Fixed pricing is common. It's everywhere. It's in electronics. It's cars, food, entertainment. In fact, this morning I looked up the AARP membership, and I was wondering if that was a monthly fee, and it's not. It's an annual fee, whether you use the service or not, I mean, fixed pricing is just so common anymore. And this one's very important, relatively uniform class usage. MDU's costs in a class cost of service are allocated into three buckets. They're allocated into customer costs, demand costs, energy costs. And so I think the customer charges would naturally fall, the customer costs would naturally fall to a customer charge, and the energy costs would naturally fall to an energy charge. And as we've learned through this proceeding, for the most part, there isn't any energy costs other than the cost of the commodity, the commodity cost of gas. And so the question, and Commissioner Fedorchuk was getting very close yesterday in her questioning about demand costs. So the demand costs are the piece that we have to figure out what to do with. Should it go in the fixed cost? Should it go in the variable cost? if there is extreme variability in the class, so that, let me just use my arms here, if we had a gas pipe this big and a customer that uses a million decatherms a year and another customer in the same class that uses 10, well, of course you'd have to figure out some kind of usage charge to accommodate that huge difference in consumed capacity, right? You'd have to. And that's why we have demand costs in the other classes, because the variability in consumption is huge. It's one of the responses I made to AARP's interrogatories to myself. I think it was an I probably have it right here. Here, just right on top. In rate 81, the interruptible transportation gas service, customer number 58 used 911 decatherms in the first 5 months of 2015. Whereas customer number 62 used 72,399. Well, you've got to have some way of adjusting revenues, adjusting rates for that kind of difference. In the residential class, we don't have that kind of class usage disparity. One way you can think, and here's the proof in the pudding, it's a very simplistic illustration, but we know that an average size home in Bismarck and North Dakota is around 2,000 square feet. And I'm not suggesting that square feet is necessarily a determinant of how much gas you use, but just bear with me. So if that's true, about 2,000 square foot, we know that small homes are around 1,000 feet and there's not much above 3,000 feet. And so we also know, to be perfectly honest, we know that most, that there is some correlation. I wouldn't even say that. Just maybe this is a bad illustration, but it shows that most of the gas is used for heating. Let's go with that. Most of the gas is used for heating. And so if heat is based on square feet, then you could see that there wouldn't be a lot of variability in class usage. I also have seen Madison Gas and Electric. Maybe this would have been a better example. a dispersion graph. And they're kind of in the same climate. And so what they do is they show percent of customers by usage. And so you have a curve like this. It's not a curve like this, it's a curve like this. And so most usage falls between 50 decatherms and 150 decatherms a year. And so since there isn't a lot of difference in the classes, I believe that demand costs assigned in the class cost of service study can appropriately be assigned to the fixed cost. The last two bullets, I'll just talk together. Diminishes customer confusion and more transparent. eliminates multiple volume charges, volumetric charges, and the rate increases can't be easily hidden or distorted. And I picked that up from Tony Clark's consenting opinion. I don't know if it was 2005 or 2007, but in his consenting opinion, he talked about this a little bit, that when you have a volumetric charge of pennies, cents, you can easily hide rate increases. You just, well, we're going to increase the distribution delivery charge by 50 cents. Customers may not know what that means to them. They will know what it means to them if you get rid of the distribution delivery charge and the rate is going from $18.48 to $22. That's very easy to understand. There'll be no hiding on the commission's part or the company's part or AARP's part. It will be very clear. There won't be any distribution delivery charge to confuse customers with. And so I believe it's straight fixed variable rate is more transparent, and it will help with customer confusion. And that concludes my opening comments.
All right, this time we turn to the witness.
Mr. Kuntz.
We have no questions.
Mr. Kaufman.
Yes, I have a few questions. Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Diller.
Good morning.
So you have a significant policy disagreement with AARP's in this case, and we're going to talk about that, but I think we have an awful lot that we do agree with, so hopefully we can find out what those are, too. Let me just start with your direct testimony. Is it fair to say that you believe that a class cost of service study is valuable as a guide, but it should be tempered with practical considerations and other rate-making factors such as gradualism and public acceptance? And
true. Yes, yeah. I do. Yep.
Well, certainly agree with you there.
Good.
I think maybe we maybe would prefer you looked at the class cost of study less when you're assigning them between classes and maybe more so within the residential class, but we certainly agree that it's a balance between the study and other concerns. Right? You also stated as sort of a rule of thumb or a general practice that the commission shouldn't assign a greater percentage than twice the overall rate increase or less than one half the overall rate increase to one class of customers. Is that something you generally believe is a good practice?
It depends.
Okay. But that was in your direct testimony, right?
It's a reasonable approach, but I've not advocated that here, so that's why I say it depends.
You stated in the data request response that you were abandoning those principles for this particular case.
There
right?
you go.
Okay. And that's partly for some of the reasons you were talking about earlier. Right?
That's right.
Now, let me go back just to the general idea that you got to balance the cost study with practical concerns. Is that something that you also think should apply within the residential class between high users and small users? That you should also give the cost study some merit and some consideration as well as practical concerns?
I'm not sure I'm following you. Can you break it down for me?
Is it important to look at a cost study when you are making rate case or rate making decisions that affect different customers within a class?
Well, the class cost of service study, it allocates costs to the various classes of customers. I don't know that it allocates costs down to individual users.
Do you think a cost of service study has no value in making decisions such as how the components would affect customers within the class, such as between low residential users and high residential users?
Well, maybe you're getting to the uniform class usage that I've just spoke about, but I think I've described it fairly succinctly there about the difference between the residential class and other classes, that the class usage is fairly uniform, and so I don't know if I can help you any further.
My question was, do you think that the cost of service study provides any helpful guidance apart from assigning it to each class, but is it helpful in making decisions about, you know, how much of the residential rate should be based on a flat fee and how much should be based on volumetric usage? Does it have any guidance?
Well, I think I talked to that, right? The customer costs should be reflected in the customer charge, and the energy should be reflected in the energy charge, and the demand costs. We don't have demand meters, so we have to decide some way of allocating demand costs, either fixed or variable.
But if you go to just one flat fee for the residential delivery cost, aren't you ignoring the guidance that the cost study suggests that demand and energy has some impact, at least?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. But you think the policy considerations you've raised outweigh following the cost study within the residential class?
That's right.
Okay. Also, a general statement from your direct testimony was that, you know, if there's some issue that the commission is looking at between the ratepayers as a whole and the utility, that the commission should err on the side of ratepayers. Is that fair?
That's my testimony.
Okay. Now, if the commission is faced with a decision that would favor small users over large users, do you think that the commission should err on the side of small users over large users, or they should be indifferent within the residential class?
I guess indifferent.
Okay. Fair enough. So back to the idea of the cost study, and that it shouldn't be a formulaic or mechanical approach, that you got to apply some common sense to, right, which I wholeheartedly agree with. We only have one cost study in this case, right? And you testified earlier that, you know, a cost study has a lot of inputs that are subjective, and so you can make it say just about anything you want it to say, right?
You can.
Right. So would you agree with me that if in a case where you only have one study and no other party has done a complete class cost of service study, that you should be even more skeptical of that study?
Well, I'm trying to think if I recall ever seeing someone else construct a class cost of service study from scratch in a rate case proceeding. I haven't witnessed that. Generally, the class cost of service study is something that's developed over many, many years, over through many, many rate cases.
I'm sorry.
So the commission, you know, used the same class cost of service study in the last MDU rate case. So you're building on something over time.
So you've never performed your own class cost of service study?
I have not performed.
You've not been involved in a rate case where another, like a consumer party, has done their own study to kind of compare the two studies?
Most of the time, my experience is they do the same thing that I've done. They make some adjustments to the company's class cost of service study. And I think it's fairly effective because distribution mains represent about half of the plant in service. And so if you want to find out if I change this,
right,
then what effect does that have on the end results? It's a quick way to develop a range of reasonableness.
And you're experienced enough in reviewing these cost studies that you know what inputs are, you know, create the most variance in the end result.
Sure.
So you're able to suggest, or what if you rerun this study by changing this input and that input, and then you can.
That's been my experience my entire career. I've not seen anyone come with a new class cost of service study.
And in this case, you made one suggested change that did benefit the residential class, correct?
That's right.
Which was on distribution mains. Instead of dividing it 75% customer and 25%, you suggest 100%. And that
100% demand-related, right?
Demand-related,
yep.
And that
yep.
provided some relief to residential class.
Yes.
We appreciate that. Thank you. And it's your testimony that distribution main costs do not vary with the incidence of customers. Is that right? On page 16 of your testimony?
All right, that sounds right.
Or you say, rather in most cases.
Which line are you on?
Line 1-3 on page 16 of your direct.
Right. In most cases, a new service within an area requires only connecting a service line to an existing main, and thus the distribution main costs do not vary with the incidence of customers.
Would you you think that it might in some cases differ, though, with the size of the homes or the size of the customers in a particular area? What size distribution mains are needed?
Well, I think the I think that somebody used a local Ritzy, I don't remember where, where was what's that?
Promontory Point.
Okay. I think there's always exceptions to everything, and so a lot of times we speak in generalities so that, I mean, we can't encompass every possible situation. And so if you have 10,000 square foot homes being built, you might, maybe, I don't know that for a fact, but maybe the mains would be a different size. I know based on Tammy's testimony, 62% of the mains are 2-inch. So it sounds like 2-inch is is a size that's used a lot, and so I just don't have.
Or
I can't
if you were,
answer that.
And you know, if you were looking at two homes in the same subdivision, it's unlikely that the mains to their home would be different size.
Any different, right?
But perhaps if you had a, you were comparing two subdivisions, one of some homes with small square footage as opposed to what Promontory Point or
yep.
some large homes,
monster houses,
right? That right. You would probably have.
I just don't know.
It would at least theoretically be possible you would have a different size distribution main
possible.
To each of those subdivisions?
Well, it'd be theoretically possible, but I don't know.
You haven't done any study to determine that, right?
I don't know.
And you haven't looked at the specific distribution of usage amongst the customers in the residential class for MDU for this case, have you?
Not for MDU. It'd be a great late filed exhibit, but MDU would have to provide it. So,
well, we wouldn't have a chance to look at that and ask questions about it, would we? But you're speculating that generally the usage is grouped together and close enough for
speculating. I like to think of it as common sense and. I suspect that Madison Gas and Electric, that's the one that comes to mind, is in a similar climate. And so I suspect their usage is similar to ours.
Let me just continue to ask a couple more questions about your direct testimony. On page 18, you were talking about the practicality you're making, and you state that customers never like rate increases. They generally understand that the cost of everything continues to go up. Is that your testimony?
That's what I read.
Right. But wouldn't you say, as far as energy costs go, the customers do recognize that the cost of natural gases has gone down as well as up?
Some. I'd say some do and some don't.
Wouldn't you say that most customers would expect that they pay the correct rate and not necessarily see their rates always go up, but sometimes go down if the costs justify that?
we talked about that yesterday. The cost of gas evidently has gone down a dollar since they filed this case. So,
And when we're talking about customers' general experiences, you know, most everyone has the experience of going to the filling station and seeing that the price of gasoline has gone down, right? So they,
right,
they know that energy prices can go down as well as up, right?
Yes.
Right. And in your experience as a regulator, have you seen regulated utilities that actually have had their revenue requirement decreased in a rate case? Or heard of such cases that...
So a company filed for a rate increase and it actually got a rate decrease out of the deal? Is
that
what you're suggesting?
Or that there was a complaint or a, you know, say a commission staff, you know...
Yeah, I don't know if I'd call it rate cases, but yes, this I have reached settlement agreements with companies where we agreed to reduce rates because earnings levels were too high.
Right. There might be a need to change the rate of return or depreciation has reduced the need to, for the current rates or over, you know, over earnings have reached a certain level.
Whatever's driving the over earnings.
Here are just some minor points. Page 21, you talk about the profit margins that result from large interruptible class. You say, from page 20 to 21, you say retaining interruptible customers is important and that they provide profit margins that are beneficial to the rest of the customer classes?
Yes.
Do you know the magnitude of those profit margins for MDU?
The magnitude of the profit margins? Yes, well, they're earning. So the small interruptible class is providing margins before the settlement of 3.37%, and the return for large interruptible is 10.58%.
Okay, so when you say profit margins, are you referring to the calculation?
Rate of return. I'm just...
The contribution to the rate of return of the utility, that's
well,
what you mean?
Well, the earnings, they're earning 10.58% on their large interruptible assets and 3.37 on the small interruptible.
And you believe that outweighs the additional increase that the residential class would receive in order to keep the large interruptibles at a zero level in this case?
I'm not sure I understood the question.
Well, I'm asking, there's not a contribution. I guess my question is that your testimony here is based on an assumption that if the large interruptible class receives too high of a rate increase that they might leave the system?
That's right.
That's what you're getting at? Okay. And it's a benefit to the residential class to keep their rates low so that they don't leave the system and then require other customer classes to pick up the difference.
Hopefully my testimony says that we should maximize earnings from the interruptible customers and to keep them on the system so that it provides a benefit to the firm class.
And you think a zero level increase is meets that appropriate balance?
To the large interruptibles that are now providing 10.58% rate of return,
yes.
When we're settling on 7.34, and I believe you're part of that settlement, it seems like a reasonable rate of return, but as I indicated in my opening comments, I think it should be market-based, and I don't have the capability of determining what market-based rates are. That's where I'm trusting in the company's knowledge of operating a gas operating system or a local distribution company, that they know what that line is.
And because MDU thinks that the large interruptible class will be fine with zero increase, you think that's
well?
Think that's
again
enough that they're contributing enough in this rate increase.
I am not in the position to determine what a market-priced rate is for interruptible customers.
Okay.
And I would also suggest that you look at what we've done with those two classes. One's providing a 10.5% return, and the other we're increasing 7%.
Okay. Let me just move on to the points that you make starting on page 22 and page 23 and 24 regarding the basic service charge, the straight fixed variable rate design. You did make some modification to your testimony here on the stand with regard to paragraph number 3 on page 23, where you say there was no cost basis in this proceeding. In the previous proceeding.
NSP's proceeding.
Yep. I apologize. And that you think that the 3 cents that might be justified per decatherm in this case is just not significant enough to worry about?
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah.
Okay.
It's
close enough for horseshoes, we were saying.
Well,
I might as well go all the way.
Well, think about it. The average customer uses 94 decatherms. Let's round it up to 100 to make it easy. 100 decatherms a year times 3 cents, $3, divided by 12 bills. It just doesn't make any sense to me.
A year and a half ago, residential customers were only paying a $9 basic service charge, right? And they had a much higher per decatherm rate, didn't they?
I'm sorry.
I'm just asking you to look at this from the perspective of the previous MDU case and this UD case. So from a customer perspective, a year and a half or 2 years ago, they had to pay a $9 fixed charge, $9.
Okay, before the last rate case?
Correct.
Okay.
And so that's the... So if you're looking at just the last couple of years, we're starting with a $9 customer charge, and you're suggesting in this case going to a $19 plus basic service charge, right? And
9 to 15 and 15 to 1960, I think is, yeah.
And then correspondingly, there was more of a usage-based DDC.
Well, I don't recall exactly, but I think the first go around, we lowered the distribution delivery charge from 80 cents to 30 cents, and now we're talking about getting rid of the 30 cents altogether. So, okay. That all fits into what customers are ultimately paying.
But if you're looking at this from a perspective of how quickly rates are changing from the previous 2 years, you started with an 80 cent charge, right? Does that seem significant to you from going over 2 years from 80 cents to zero?
I think it is significant. It just depends on the period of time you look at. If you look at the last 10 years, the rates have increased twice in the last 2 years. So if you look at 10-year period, that seems pretty reasonable. Also seems reasonable if you understand the kinds of investments that are being made. And I think generally people can understand that if your rate base goes from 20 million to whatever the number was, 100 and some million, they understand that you have to pay for that.
Well, focusing just on the residential class and how you charge the residential class,
sure.
Over how many years has there been a usage component in there for the MDU? 100 years? 50 years?
I don't know.
But for as long as you can remember, right?
There's always a usage charge. We've always charged them the cost of gas. I don't know if distribution delivery charge was always in the customer bill or not. I don't know.
But we're not gas costs are not before us today, right? They're not on the cost of gas isn't what we're discussing in this case, right?
We're talking about rate design. Yep.
Okay. And you talk a lot about your belief that customers are familiar or accustomed to fixed charges in their daily lives. Is that a fair summary of your testimony?
Yes.
You think being familiar with fixed charges in various areas is the same thing as preferring that they be fixed charges?
I don't know.
Right. You know, let's take cable television, for instance. Would you be surprised that customers generally are unhappy that they have to pay a fixed charge and would rather pay based on usage to some degree?
I'd rather not pay anything.
Right. Right.
So.
Well, isn't it true with, even with cable television, you have pay-per-view and you have premium channels. There's additional usage-based charges that most people experience as well as their fixed monthly fee, right?
Yes, there's those services.
And with many phones, mobile telephone plans, there are additional charges if you use over a certain amount, and there are additional fees for different...
I guess it depends on your fixed contract.
Right, right.
Yeah.
You describe the straight fixed variable rate as a decoupling mechanism, and and you believe it's favorable to decoupling mechanisms that are complicated formulas.
Well, I don't know how it could be any simpler.
Right. Well, I can agree with you that I disfavor complicated decoupling mechanisms, but is this straight fixed variable doesn't decouple the way many decoupling mechanisms do, in that they does not actually sever earnings from sales, does it? Does it?
You're asking me if straight fixed variable.
It's not exactly decoupling, is it?
I think it is, but if you have a better idea, then please.
Well, tell me how straight fixed variable is a decoupling mechanism, in your opinion.
Well, the company will earn the same amount of money from residential customers, whether it's cold or warm outside, because the cost of gas is just a flow through. So there's no variability in earnings other than adding new customers.
You noted that you think that it, you know, to the degree you believe it's a decoupling mechanism, that it would eliminate the distance.
Maybe I could just, maybe this will help.
Go ahead.
So if a customer, if a utility company starts an energy efficiency program and customers start using it and they use less energy, it's decoupled. It doesn't affect the company's earnings, the fact that they're using less. The same with weather. Whether it's warmer or colder, doesn't affect earnings. So to me, that's a revenue decoupling method.
And do you believe that decoupling provides an incentive for the utility company to engage in energy efficiency projects?
There's no disincentive to do that.
Correspondingly,
I would just say that NSP brought energy efficiency to the commission, and we accepted that in the second case after going to straight fixed variable rate. So I guess you could say it incented them to come forward with the program.
There's no energy efficiency program proposal in this case, though, is there?
Nope.
Would you agree that if you do decouple a utility sales from the revenues, that there should be some agreement that's attached to that to engage in energy efficiency programs to benefit customers?
I'd have to see what the program is before I could bite on that one.
Either, does it make sense in your mind to decouple without some agreement to benefit customers with some energy efficiency programs?
I don't think that's necessary.
Okay.
Out here in the Midwest, we take charge of our own affairs, and so to a large degree, if something needs to be done in the house, we do it, and we don't expect the utility company to do it for us. But if there are programs that would benefit the whole class, the whole utility, then I don't think you need to I don't think you need to attach energy efficiency automatically to the conversion to a straight fixed variable rate.
Well, I respect your opinion. I don't want to necessarily agree that straight fixed variable is a decoupling mechanism, but if in fact it was, and it did decrease the disincentive that the utility has, wouldn't it also, at least to some small degree, reduce the incentive for a customer to engage in energy efficiency and conservation because their rates are less based on their usage?
No.
Not even to a small degree?
No.
Why is that?
Well, if you're an energy conservationist like I am, you conserve energy because that's what you believe. And I conserve energy, whether it saves me 71% or 100% or 5%. I don't think it changes anything.
You don't believe that customers would be more incentivized to engage in energy efficiency if they received an 80% benefit as opposed to a 71% benefit?
Okay, so now we're going into the financial calculation of whether to engage in energy efficiency. Sure, there would be a little bit of a difference.
And, if the commission goes with your recommendation and makes the residential charge just a fixed fee for the delivery of gas, there would be a somewhat less financial reward for conserving.
Sure.
Right. Okay. All right. So let me talk about this. You bring out the fact that winter bills are lower and summer bills are higher, and that might mitigate the seasonal variations in North Dakota.
Right. Right.
So the increase or the relief in the winter would be rather slight, but the increase in the summer would be rather large as far on a percentage basis. Would you agree with me on that?
Most likely, yes.
And
depending on customer use, but yeah.
We had a PowerPoint that Ms. Aberle put up yesterday. I don't know if you have it in front of you, the proposed residential bill changes by month.
Is it an exhibit? I see I have an exhibit.
It's exhibit 13. Page three or four, depending on how you count the pages, said proposed residential bill changes, and it has January through December on it. Do you have that?
Yes.
So you see there from, and I'm focused on months June through September, where the overall bill, even counting the gas cost, for the average residential customer will go up 14.54% in those months.
That's what this schedule shows.
And would you agree with me that if you use more than the average customer, that percentage will be less, and if you use less than the average customer, that summer increase percentage would be even larger?
Probably.
Okay. Would you be able to guess if someone used, say, half, that 48 decatherm a year customer, how much more their summer increase might be under straight fixed variable? Might it be double? Would it be 30%?
Okay. So 48 is the number. So 50 times 30 cents, right? Let's see. 50 decatherms times 30 cents, that'd be $15.
Okay.
$15, and you're increasing the customer charge by $5, so $10, mm-hmm. about.
Okay.
Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, so I was just wondering how much that increase in the summer months might be for the bills. Based on the settlement, my customers see summer bills that are maybe 20% higher if they use less than the average.
Oh, okay. So, I'm not. This is the first time I've looked at it. So,
I know it's hard to.
Pardon?
I'm not good enough in math to figure it out myself.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But I'm just wondering if you know how much the average customer under the settlement would see their bills go up by almost 15% more in the summertime, and I'm just wondering about a small user.
Well,
they would see more. I just don't know exactly how much more.
I haven't done the math.
Okay. Fair enough. Recognizing that the summer gas bills are going to be higher than people are used to experiencing, and I assume you would expect some customers would notice a 15% rate increase or more on their summer bills. Would you think some customers probably would.
Yeah.
You think it might be high enough to incentivize some customers to ask that their service be disconnected in the summertime? Mm-hmm. They're not using it.
Well, they'd have to think long and hard about that because there is a reconnection fee. So if you disconnect and then you come back in the wintertime, you're going to pay the customer charge for all those months that you were disconnected.
So the reconnection fee is based on what you would have paid in that interim over the last 12 months.
That's right, and that's just to recognize the fixed costs that are in place for you to take gas, whether you use it or not.
Do you get a lot of complaints from customers paying their gas bills in the summertime? No.
I don't think so. Okay. I'm not the main customer complaint person, but I don't think we get a lot of complaints about gas bills in the summertime.
Now, currently, if a customer is concerned about the fact that their winter bill is so high, they have the option of going on balanced billing, correct?
Sure.
So customers currently have the option of, so if they're concerned at all about that seasonal differential, they have an easy program that they can sign up for, right?
They do. About 25% of them have signed up based on Ms. Haberle's testimony.
So is it really a concern about, whether the commission mitigates that summer winter differential if customers have the ability to completely levelize it if they want?
Well, I'd say it's those bullet points are probably less in value than some of the others.
Okay. Let's see if there's any other. I think I'm about done here. I think that'll cover it. I appreciate your answers, and thanks for having this opportunity to discuss our policy differences.
Sure.
Mr. Jernigan?
No questions. Thank you.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco, any questions?
I have a couple. Hi, Mike. You're aware, aren't you, that the large interruptible rate is basically a negotiated rate and has a minimum and a maximum? Are you aware of that?
Yes. Yes, I am.
Do you know if the customers, the seven I guess there are, if they're at the minimum, maximum, or somewhere in between?
I think most of them are at the maximum. There may be one that's not, but... Okay.
Thank you.
Sure.
I think we'll take a break at this time before we continue with the questions from commissioners. We'll come back at about 5 minutes till. So, thanks.
Coming back at 5:02?
Yeah.
Okay, not in 5 minutes?
Right.
Okay.